This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rhett Miller, is the lead singer and songwriter of the band Old 97s, and he records under his own name. He's here with his guitar to play some of his new and old songs and some of the songs that have influenced him. The Old 97s have a new CD called Blame It on Gravity. In the New Yorker magazine, Ben Greenman described the band as occupying a valuable sliver near the border of alternative country and power pop. In the New York Times, John Pareles described the Old 97s as playing roots rock from a Texas perspective with honky-tonk shuffles and galloping country rock alongside Mersey Beat-flavored songs that owe as much to the Replacements as the Beatles. Rhett Miller, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really such a pleasure to have you here.
I'm honored to be here.
I want you to start with a solo version of Dance With Me, which is on the new CD. If there's a story behind the song, please tell it to us.
Yeah. I have kids now. I've got a 4.5-year-old son, Max, and a 2-year-old daughter named Soleil. And it's hard once you have kids to find, you know, to eke out those moments. And we were on our annual trip to Cancun. I sat out at 5 in the morning. Soleil had woken up. And so I was taking care of her, and we were out on the balcony. And I sat and watched the sunset come up. And I imagined there was a couple down on the beach in the distance. And I imagined this story for them, which is how a lot of my songs come about. And I hope that the stories of these real people and their real stories are nothing like the stories I conjure up for them. But in this case, it was a Latin lover and a girl who was straying from her true love back home. And the song bounces back and forth between the guy back at home and, I guess, the narrator who's sort of admonishing her. All right, I'll play you a little bit of this. It's Dance With Me.
Underneath the foreign stars in a foreign place where they don't love you, I do tan in the pale moonlight. Your eyes are wide in the band plays. Everybody wants you. He takes your hand tenderly and he whispers, sweet surrender, nothing's how he feels about girls like you with your flip-flop smiles and your big blue eyes on vacation. Dance with me into the ocean, roll with me into the sea. Don't tell me the world is in trouble. Do you want to dance with me? Love changes hands as the big waves crash and the dream don't die, but I do. Where were you when I needed you right now? The telephone just rings, I cannot find you. Dance with me into the ocean, roll with me into the sea. Don't tell me the world is in trouble. Don't tell me the world is in trouble. Dance with me into the ocean, roll with me into the sea. Don't tell me the world is in trouble. Do you want to dance with me? Oh, do you want to dance with me? Do you want to dance with me?
That's great. That's Rhett Miller singing a song that's also featured on the new Old 97s CD, which is called Blame It on Gravity. How do you think the sound of the Old 97s has changed over the years? I think initially you were thought of as alt-country, and you know you could hear that on the early CDs, but I think you've really diversified.
The intention of our band when we first started this band was to be a folk music band that would play in coffee houses and that would, by definition, not have to worry about getting signed to a major label or having a, you know, any kind of huge success, because the bass player Murray and I had tried for so long to make these rock bands that I think this was because I had put a record out in high school and Billboard magazine had said that A&R guys would be knocking down my door. And I took that to heart a little bit. And at the time, remember, in the late 80s, early 90s, that was it. You know, if you got a major label contract, which is so funny to think that getting to sign a contract would be the home run, the end of the game, you know. So, but we got sick of it. And it was, I remember it was around the time Nirvana broke. And I really thought that they were a great band, but I thought, this is not what I want to be doing. I don't want to be chasing, you know, some brass ring that I'll never get that doesn't really mean anything to me to begin with. And so we quit for a few months, 6 months, and then started up from scratch with the Old 97s. And even the name, I felt like even the name was going to be difficult and contrary in a way that I felt like was to our benefit. It would keep us, you know, from having to worry about that.
You know, you mentioned that when you started performing, you were really listening to a lot of folk music and saw yourself as performing folk music. Mm-hmm. One of the tracks on the new CD, Blame It on Gravity, is very folk music influenced, and it's called Here's to the Halcyon.
Yeah.
Maybe you could play an excerpt of that for us and tell us first what inspired the song.
Well, the Halcyon has become sort of a motif in my songs. I had a reference to it in a song on The Instigator. Let's call her Halcyon and hope that she holds a world inside the world, was that song. And so Halcyon reappears on this record, and it's just, you know, from the great line of songs about wrecks. You know, the old 97 was a train wreck song, and there's a lot of great shipwreck songs, you know. But here's to the Halcyon. I just imagined a guy, you know, adrift and afloat and looking for anything. It was a story my dad had told me when I was a kid about his motorcycle accident. And he had come very close to death and had broken his back and was laid up for a long time. And when he was in the hospital, he, you know, sort of made a deal with God. And his deal with God was, look, I'll be a better person if you just let me make it through this.
Well, this is definitely a deal with God song.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Would you play some of it for us?
Sure. Get me through this, Lord, and I'll do anything you say. Live right, read the good book, I'll settle down and pray. When Gabriel blows his horn, I know things might not go my way. Get me through this, Lord, and I'll do anything you say. Pluck me from this driftwood, Lord, I'll be a better man. Raise me from the deep sea in the palm of your great hand. Let me see tomorrow and I'll try to understand how the sinking of my little vessel fits into your plan. Here's to the Halcyon, forever may she rest at the bottom of the ocean, for the good Lord knows best. You raised her from lumber and you gave her to the sea. Now, good Lord, what do you propose to do with me? Get me through this, Lord, and I'll devote my life to you. Things look pretty bleak right now, but I know you'll come through. Well, I've squandered my good fortune and my other fortune too. Get me through this, Lord, and I'll devote my life to you. I cannot change my past mistakes. I've led a life devoid of virtue. Either way, the man I am is dead and gone, although I know the past can come around to hurt you.
That's great. I really like that song.
Thanks.
So, you know, you were saying that the song was inspired in part by your father, who made a deal with God after his motorcycle accident. So he obviously got through the accident.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So did he make good on the deal with God?
That's funny. That's a good question. I think for a little while he did, and I think he had to ride out some tough years, too. He got married. My mom and him got married really young, and I'm glad I didn't do that. You know, I was in love with some truly exceptional people during my 20s, but I'm really glad I didn't wind up married to any of them. But,
well, I hope they're not listening.
I know. Well, no, they're good. I think they would probably agree. They're all in good places, I think. There are not that many of them. But my dad, he did pretty good, I think. He wrote it out for a number of years. Now he does a lot of pro bono work. He works on behalf of people who are being pursued by debt collectors, you know, the less fortunate, the people who need a really good attorney, which is what he is, my dad.
You went to a private high school that was, I think, an Episcopalian school?
Yeah, St. Mark's School of Texas.
So did you grow up with a lot of religion in your life?
I did. I was an altar boy. I sang in choirs. Every Wednesday morning I was, you know, lighting the candle and wearing robes and singing in the choir. I was around it. It wasn't hardcore old-time Southern Baptist, although a lot of my friends were that, and I had a few close calls where I'd go to church with them and get kicked out for asking the wrong question in Bible school.
So, you know, it's interesting that you went from, you know, altar boy to, you know, with the robes,
and the
vestments, to like punk clubs. And
I did.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole 360 there. Yeah.
I did, but it's all part of the same thing. Like you, we were talking about folk music, and I was thinking back. My kids just got into this record I have by the Cramps, this New York-based punkabilly, whatever, crazy band that I saw a number of times play. And I used to cover a song of theirs called TV Set, and I just would play it as if it were a folk song when it's about decapitation and it's all horror movie kind of imagery. And my kids now have been listening to the Cramps, and we get in the car every day and they yell, Goo Goo Muck, I want to hear Goo Goo Muck. And it's maybe a little over their heads. There's a couple of songs I have to skip, like Drug Train. I don't want them to hear Drug Train yet.
You want to do a few bars of that as a folk song?
Sure, sure. What is it? God, I have not played this in 20 years. Oh, baby, I see you in my TV set. Oh, baby, I see you in my TV set. I cut your head off and put it in my TV set. I use your eyeballs for dials on my TV set. I watch TV. I watch TV. Since I put you in my TV set, oh baby, I hear you on my radio. I hear you on my radio. I go flip, flip, flip for you, lady. Oh, you're going drip, drip, drip inside my radio. AM radio, PM radio. Since I put you in my radio like this. And on and on and on.
Oh, that's great. That's so much fun. I could see how your kid would really love it, too.
Yeah.
It's really catchy.
It's cartoony.
Now, one of the songs that you do on the new CD, Blame It on Gravity, has, I mean, as soon as I saw the name of it, before I'd heard it, I thought, I have to figure out what this title is about. It's called No Baby I.
Oh, yeah.
Letter I, as in I am, not as in E-Y-E. So No Baby I. And I thought, what does that mean? And, of course, when I heard the song, I got it. But it's a strange construction to keep the I for the title.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the song and deciding to keep the eye on the title, and then I'll ask you to do it.
It's funny, Terry. Everything you ask seems like you must be reading my notebooks. I had a song called No Carol. Oh, that song was actually called No Carol I first, just from the abbreviation of North. And I kept thinking of this guy writing back to this girl in Carolina, and her name's I don't know. I mean, it was just, you know, this sort of fevered dream of a song, No Carol I, No Carol I, No Carol I, Don't Want to See You Hurt. And I was living with it, and it bothered me because I thought it was a little too weird, you know, for one thing. And also, I've got so many songs with women's names in them. My mom keeps telling me I need to release an album of all my songs put together that have, you know, Doreen and Victoria and on and on and on. Help me, Suzanne. I just kind of decided I can't have No Carol I. And I didn't even know a Carol. It seems like sort of an old-timey, clunky name. So I'm being the flexible, you know, writer that I am, I turned it into No Baby I. But I still liked the meter of that as a title, as a phrase, No Baby I.
So play the song, and then we'll hear where the I fits in.
Okay.
The lights were low, but I was lower, and the radio was playing somewhere else. The room was full of surface tension, but I was only thinking about myself. No baby I, no baby I, no baby I, don't want to see you hurt. You got them tears, they fall like pearls. Blame it on gravity, yeah. Blame it on being a girl. And the room was full of undertakers, the movers and martini shakers gone, and the reaper left at 7:30, and he took off in a taxi with a blonde. The difference between us is way down on the inside, and it's very tricky business. No baby I, no baby I, no baby I, don't wanna see you hurt. You got them tears, they fall like pearls. Blame it on gravity, yeah. Blame it on being a girl. Oh, blame it on gravity, yeah. Blame it on being a girl.
That's Rhett Miller singing one of the songs he wrote that's included on the new Old 97s CD, which is called Blame It on Gravity. And obviously that line comes from the song that he just did. And but he should name the CD Blame It on Gravity, then Blame It on Being a Girl.
I had a really tough time about that phrase. I briefly attended Sarah Lawrence College because it was purported to be the best school for writing, and I ended up deciding that there's no school for writing. I mean, for me, there wasn't, and so I dropped out. But even though I grew up in Texas, I know you're not allowed to call women girls.
I've read that when you were in high school, you've said this, that you were bullied a lot, and a lot of people called you faggot.
Yeah.
What earned you the name?
I had rosy cheeks. I had long eyelashes. I was, in the choir. I don't know. I mean, I think back to there was a dean of students who was gay, who was a soccer coach. And one day I was playing intramural soccer and I was getting that, I was getting picked on that day a lot for whatever reason. And he pulled me off to the side. He goes, you know why they call you that, right? And I said, why? He said, because they can't think of anything else to call you. And I thought, that's a good point. These are kids that are, just pubescent. They're dealing with issues that are so tough. I remember one of the kids, obviously I won't mention his name, but I found out years later it was, getting pretty badly abused at home. And he was one of the ringleaders. And, I think back on them and I can't hold a grudge, they were doing their best.
Let me know if this is too personal, but I read that when you were 14, mm-hmm. you tried to kill yourself.
Yeah.
And I guess I was, reading that, I couldn't help but wonder whether that was precipitated by, one turning point event that was so upsetting you couldn't deal with it, or that it was just, a whole string of things and an ongoing mood that you could no longer live with.
It was my 14th year, and I've found since then that tends to be the hardest year for, especially for kids that are kind of sensitive and kind of outsiders. It was a bad day. I was supposed to—I don't even remember the exact circumstances, but I was supposed to get a ride. My girlfriend was mad at me. My mom was mad at me. But it really had a lot more to do with this— There was one moment I was walking down the stairs of my mom's house and I looked up and there was a brass cat, a quarter inch thick brass sculpture of a cat, just a little tchotchke. And it was up on a window frame and I looked at it and I thought, that's it. That's all there is. This is it. There's just accumulating tchotchkes, placing them throughout your house, walking past them, and then dying. And it was sort of just, it was such a whammy. It was such an existential whammy. And I thought, there's more to this, but I imagine it probably comes after you die, and then there's some other thing that's next. And I couldn't really figure out why I would want to go on living at that point. And it was just such a overwhelming, impulse. And I think it had a lot to do with my parents were having a lot of trouble then. They eventually would divorce after years of probably they should have divorced, for years. So that was it. I mean, just like a switch went off. And it should have worked. I mean, it wasn't one of those sort of like I took two Valium and told everyone in the world that I had, attempted suicide. I took everything that had a skull and crossbones in the house and drank it or swallowed it. And then I, ran as far as I could away from the house down some railroad tracks until I collapsed. And, it should have worked. And now I'm glad that it didn't, and obviously. And now I've discovered that there is a lot of meaning to be found in this life. And I've done since then everything I could to talk to kids that I felt like were having trouble. And that's part of why I make music, because when I came out of that, the thing that I felt like saved me were my records,
Who found you on the railroad tracks after you collapsed there?
A girl named Barry Krantz, who was a senior at Arts Magnet High School. We ended up going out on a date months and months later.
She
reached into my pocket and found me, because I was blue, and pulled out a wallet and found my girlfriend at the time's phone number and her father, the girlfriend at the time. Her father was a doctor, and they drove there and picked me up and took me to the emergency room, and they, induced vomiting all night. And I made it.
There's a song I want to ask you to sing. It's a song I really like that you wrote, that the old 97s do. It's called Lonely Holiday. And one of the reasons I'm going to ask you to do it here is there's references to suicide in the song. Yeah. And I figure when you've tried to take your life and come out the other end, you don't use that word lightly.
Yeah.
You don't refer to that lightly. Can you talk about writing this song?
It was a bit of a dark period for me. I had moved out to L.A. I was in a relationship wherein the dynamic wasn't totally healthy. I was traveling a lot for the first time. The 97s had toured what seemed like a lot before that, but it seemed like a lot because we were so broke and we were driving ourselves in a van. Suddenly I was touring for 12 weeks, you know, without coming home. And that's hard, and it's hard on a relationship. And you know, I wouldn't have wanted to be on the other end of it, you know, at home alone for 12 weeks, you know, wondering, you know, where my loved one was. And so I wrote this song sort of from the perspective of the loved one waiting at home. All right. Lonely Holiday.
It was a lonely holiday. I was alone. You were away in Fayetteville or in another state. And there's so many towns I hate when you leave me. Breaks me like a bone, but it's never as bad as when you come home. I've thought so much about suicide. Parts of me have already died. Lonely, baby, I'm not lonely. Baby, I'm not, I got my imaginary friends. Happy, baby, I'm so happy. Baby, I'm so, I got my imaginary friends. And if you don't love me, would you please pretend?
It's a great song.
Thanks.
How did you feel about referring to suicide in it?
I knew I had to be careful because, like you said, it wasn't, you know, it's not an empty word. It's a very, you know, powerful, loaded, scary thing because the human condition is... it's agony in a lot of ways. And that I remember that that was a period when, for the first time since I'd been 14, I was really feeling that again. And I'm sure it had a lot to do with, you know, just really being in this position with my career where things were really happening and taking off. And it just, the stakes all seemed so high. You know, everything, it's tough. I mean, there's so many little balancing acts, being in the public eye and creating art. Lately, I've realized that I had a Google alert for my name, which is where they email you every day. Google emails you if anybody blogs about you, that verb that we all love. And I was getting every day, you know, with the new record out and everything else, I was getting these alerts and anybody's opinion that they felt like posting was coming to me, and it was just too much. I would be on stage thinking about the girl that wrote, "I saw Rhett Miller in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he has not aged well," you know? And I'm like, and it was just in my head. And so there's just a lot of that. It's a tough gig, this weird life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is songwriter and singer Rhett Miller, and he's the lead singer of the Old 97s, also records under his own name. The Old 97s have a new CD called Blame It on Gravity. And Rhett Miller's here with his guitar. You know what I'd like you to do? I'd like to ask you to redeem a song, which I sometimes do with musicians when they're on the show, to take a song that you think most people think of as corny or square or overly sentimental, a song that isn't exactly beloved among the people you know, that you happen to really love.
Yeah.
Tell us why you love it and play a bit of it for us.
There is a song that I think needed a little redemption from a band that needs redemption in general. The Kingston Trio were favorites of my parents when I was growing up, and it was before I was rebelling against anything, and I just ate it up. They were so funny. I actually stole a line from a live record on Live at the Hungry Eye. They come back from their encore, and I say this all the time now. They come back for their encore, and they say, "You can tell by the speed of our return that exit was fraudulent." I just love it. I just love it. But they were so smart, and they were so dorky, and they wore, you know, matching sort of chinos and tucked in, you know, short sleeve button downs, And, you know, they were so square. And I loved them. And I went with my parents to see them play at a little dinner theater called Mama's in Dallas. And I remember being 6 years old and thinking, as they busted out their version of Blowin' in the Wind, which they had a pretty big hit with that song, thinking, even at 6 years old, thinking, I wonder if they're sick of singing this song. I think about that all the time now, actually. But there's a lot of songs. Really, any song of theirs would probably fit the bill as far as In Need of Redemption. But there's one song that I still think about all the time. There's logistical problems with this song that I could never get past. It's the story of a guy who gets trapped in a subway. And they've raised the fare while he's on the subway. And his wife comes in every day and brings him a sandwich and hands him a paper bag through the window. And I kept thinking when I was a kid, like, why doesn't she put a nickel in the bag with the sandwich? I mean, come on, people. But they were making a point, so I understood. So I'll play a little bit. This is called MTA.
Well, let me tell you of a story of a man named Charlie on a tragic and fateful day. A heap of ten cents in his pocket, kissed his wife and family, went to ride out on the MTA. What, did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Well, Charlie handed in his dime at the Kendall Square station and changed for Jamaica Way. But when he got there, the conductor told him one more nickel. Charlie couldn't get off of that train. Or did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. He may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. Charlie's wife goes down to the Kendall Square station every day at 2:15. And through the open window she hands Charlie a sandwich as the train goes rumbling through. But did he ever return? No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned. But he may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned. He's the man who never returned. He's the man who never returned. Woo-hoo! Is that you, Charlie?
I was holding myself back from doing the poor old Charlie part.
So you remember it. Yeah.
I do. It's funny, you know, going to tell you a story part at the beginning. It sounds like it's going to be the Beverly Hillbillies theme.
It does.
So you were into the Kingston Trio.
I was. I still have all the LPs.
Do you really?
In my basement at home, yeah.
That's why you so vividly remember the dorky clothes they wore.
I know, yeah. But they were sweet, though. They were just so smart. Them and Tom Lehrer. There was like this whole... Mm-hmm. Contingent, you know, Pete Seeger was actually a big, you know, we were big fans of him in my house too. And there's this one of my earliest memories is like 5 or 6 years old. You know, this is from the files of things that you could get away with back then in the old days. My dad put me in the back of a pickup truck, Suburban type vehicle, holding onto a lawnmower that wasn't strapped in, sitting on the tailgate, which would flap up and down every time we'd go over a bump. And my job was to make sure that the lawnmower didn't fly out. And we were singing, "There'll be pie in the sky by and by, oh Lord, there'll be pie in the sky by and by." And as we're, you know, speeding down the road, and we went over a bump, and the lawnmower and I flew out and landed on a Cadillac stopped within inches of my head, and I was still singing, and I'm like, you know, I will always think of that when I hear that song.
Wow.
My dad trying to kill me. Now it's funny. Now every kid's in this, you know, like space suit basically going out in the world, which is how it should be. We want them to make it to old age or at least to 18 and then they're on their own.
My guest is Rhett Miller, the lead singer and songwriter of the band Old 97s. Let's listen to a track from their new CD, Blame It on Gravity. This is I Will Remain.
This is more than I can tolerate, the kind of pain you got to medicate. I can't remember why I couldn't wait to get so close to you. I tried to call you on the telephone, you never answer and I know you're home. I wonder why I'm so all alone while I'm so close to you. Up on a windowsill, baby, come down. Got a feeling like I wanna be. I only wanna make her notice me. Make her love me on a count of three. I am counting it down.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Rhett Miller, and he is the lead singer of the Old 97s, and the Old 97s have a new CD, which is called Blame It on Gravity, and Rhett Miller also records under his own name. You know, we were talking before about how you got a scholarship to study writing, creative writing, at Sarah Lawrence College, and you dropped out kind of quickly to do music full-time. But the only writing I've read of yours outside of song lyrics mm-hmm. is a piece that you wrote for Rolling Stone about September 11th. It was a really fine piece. It's just about your own experience of that day, living a couple of blocks away in an apartment, a couple blocks away from the World Trade Center. Mm. Could you remember some of what that day was like for us? Like, how did you realize what was going on? I remember the article said that you wrote that you were sleeping at the time the World Trade Center was attacked, and you didn't know until a friend woke you by phone to say something.
My mom. Actually, I didn't.
Was your mom?
I didn't write that. I dictated it to a Rolling Stone writer. My wife and I were asleep. It was 9:30. My mom called. She said, something's going on. We lived at Greenwich and Rector, which is about 100 yards from the base of the second tower that fell. And she said one of the towers is on fire or something. So we went up to the roof and that was the part that I think back to the most before all hell broke loose, or I guess all hell had, you know, begun to break. There were people falling, and I could see their faces, you know, or jumping or whatever. And it's not an image that is shown anymore. And I remember at the time, it appeared on a few news programs, you know, the close-ups of that. But I was there, and I was close up. I could see this one guy, his tie was flapping. He had a gray suit and a red tie, and his face just looked so peaceful. And I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm witnessing this, you know, or the disbelief that everyone felt. But so that was when things obviously got very weird. We went down to our apartment. I was eating a bowl of cereal thinking we had to pack a quick bag and get out of the neighborhood because it's going to be a madhouse, and it's probably best if we let, you know, the authorities deal with this. And then the first tower fell, and our 15th floor apartment was facing the opposite direction, facing south. So I didn't know what it was, but just was engulfed by smoke. And so we ran down the, you know, 30 flights of stairs because it was two per. Ran down 30 flights of stairs, got to the lobby. There were, you know, bloody people pouring into the lobby, which at that point you're thinking, like, God, that, you know, I was hoping to go out there and they're coming in here. So I grabbed Erica, and we went through that emergency exit, which was the corner closest to the second tower. I could see it. It was still standing. We were knee-deep in rubble and whatever. I remember seeing a lot of people's – a lot of papers, you know, just desks, you know, pieces of desks, a lot of work, you know. We ran towards Broadway, past the big Bronze Bull, and that was when that tower fell. So – we were about a minute ahead of it, and if we had walked out that door 1 minute later, you know, I don't know what would have happened, but we would not have been in a good spot. So when that tower fell, you know, hit us in the back like a big wave of debris, and we had to take our shirts off and breathe through them. I remember picking burning pieces of glass or smoking pieces of glass out of Erica's hair, and we just became part of a river of people, you know, flowing up the east side. We walked underneath the highway so that nothing would land on us, and went to the apartment of a friend, Caroline and Timmy. You know, their apartment was up in, on Houston, so we walked up there and tried to figure it all out. And the next day, we took one of the only trains that left town. The next day, we got on it and went upstate to where we live now, the Hudson Valley. We went and visited Erica's brother, and he gave us a ride a couple of days later to Ohio, and we stayed there for a couple of months till they let us go back into our place to retrieve what belongings we could in the space of 5 minutes, while a National Guardsman stood at the door with a machine gun. And I remember Erica standing at the door to the closet in the 700-square-foot loft in New York, and she's holding like six or eight pairs of high heels and just bawling, looking at them, saying, I don't know which ones to bring. And I'm like, well, I think I said, I that guy has a machine gun. You know, I think we got to go. I don't think he's going to shoot us, but I really think we should probably wrap this up. And so then we dragged those back down the 30 flights of stairs and went back another month or two later and moved our stuff out and went to L.A.
What, when you got back to your apartment and you were given 5 minutes to rescue things, what did you want to save?
My guitar, mostly my guitar. I had been without it when we were in Ohio, pictures, you know. But the guitar was the big thing, and it was
so... Was it playable? Was it in...
Yeah. Our apartment, 15 floors up facing south, was fine.
Oh.
You know, there was a lot of smoke damage because the building had been, you know, inundated by smoke. But where we were, you know, the windows held. And when we were in Ohio for the time leading up to when we were allowed to go back, I was without guitar, and I was dying to write songs. And it was so weird. You know, I had no real outlet. I guess I could have maybe gone and bought a guitar. I did write one song during that time, though. I wrote a song called She Loves the Sunset that didn't appear for years, but I wrote it on...
That's on the new CD.
It's on the new CD. I tried to get the 97s to put it on Drag It Up. I started to record it for The Believer, but I just always felt like it needed to be an old 97 song.
Would you do a little bit of it for us?
Sure.
And this is a song written by Rhett Miller that's on the new old 97 CD, and the CD is called Blame It on Gravity, and the song is called She Loves the Sunset.
She loves the sunset. She loves the cocktail bell. She loves the trembling that evening brings, or might as well. There is no other love I have known who could ever take over her throne. I love a girl. She loves the sunset. Oh, it's the simple things. Oh, but simple things are scarce. You've got to figure out about what and for whom you care. Nighttime is falling, but I fell long ago. Let's say the trembling that evening brings is just the cold. I hope I'll always be by her side, even if I'm just along for the ride. I love a girl. She loves the sunset. I love a girl. She loves the sunset. I love a girl. She loves the sunset.
That was wonderful.
Thanks.
Well, it's been really great to have you here, and I thank you so much for playing for us. It's just been such a treat.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Rhett Miller is the lead singer and songwriter of the band Old 97s. They have a new CD called Blame It on Gravity. Miller also records under his own name. Bob Kane's DC comic book Batman has had a long evolution since Kane created the character in 1939. In the 60s, it inspired the campy TV series. Then Frank Miller embraced a more nihilistic vision of urban justice in his graphic novel, The Dark Knight. In the late 80s, Tim Burton reinvented the saga, but it sputtered out after two sequels by director Joel Schumacher. The series was reborn in Batman Begins under director Christopher Nolan, best known for the film Memento. His sequel, The Dark Knight, stars Christian Bale as Batman, along with Aaron Eckhart, Maggie Gyllenhaal, and the late Heath Ledger as the Joker. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Before I talk about The Dark Knight, I should say I've been pilloried on the internet for publishing a negative review, with most of the pillorying from people who hadn't seen the movie. They'll probably love it when they do. They've invested a lot of emotional energy in it. Other critics have called it a crime epic worthy of comparison to The Godfather Part II and Michael Mann's Heat. And while it's not fair to judge a film against hype its makers didn't create, it's a measure of how high the director and co-writer Christopher Nolan aims. The Dark Knight is an impressive flight, huge in scope, nothing less than a blood-drenched allegory. In Nolan's predecessor, Batman Begins, Christian Bale's Bruce Wayne grappled with the classic urban vigilante conundrum. how, in a corrupt society, can you go outside the law to enforce the law and also maintain social harmony? Here, Bruce starts out regarding himself as beyond rules, as he announces to Michael Caine's Alfred the Butler. Talk about high-priced help.
More copycats last night, Alfred, with guns.
Why don't you hire them and take the weekend off?
That wasn't exactly what I had in mind when I said I wanted to inspire people.
I know. But things have improved. Look at the new district attorney.
I am. Closely. Need to know if you can be trusted.
I trust you don't have me followed on my day off.
You ever took one, I might.
Know your limits, Master Wayne.
Batman has no limits.
Well, you do, sir.
Well, can't afford to know him.
And what's going to happen on the day that you find out?
We all know how much you like to say, I told you so.
On that day, Master Wayne, even I won't want to.
Probably.
Batman has a counterforce, the Joker, played, as everyone knows, by the late Heath Ledger. He functions as a terrorist, a one-man insurgency, with no motivation except bringing chaos.
This town deserves a better class of criminal. And I'm going to give it to them. Tell your men they work for me now. This is my city.
They won't work for a freak.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? Hmm? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is. It's not about money. It's about sending a message.
The Joker manipulates gangsters to keep crime alive and assassinates or corrupts do-gooders like Aaron Eckhart's cleft-chin district attorney, Harvey Dent. Meanwhile, Batman's hands, or wings, are tied by pesky ethics. He can't stanch the madness. On paper, this morality play is fascinating, but a lot of the movie doesn't transcend its talking points. The psychological twists are dubious, and the plotting herky-jerky, with leaps in logic. The Dark Knight plays as if it were written by Oxford philosophy majors trying to tone up American pop. Maybe that wouldn't matter if the action weren't spectacularly incoherent. I defy you to make spatial sense of a truck, bat tank, police car chase, or the climax with Batman, the Joker, hostages, SWAT teams, fake Batman, and Morgan Freeman on some kind of sonar monitoring gizmo. The movie is really bleak, but that's not a criticism. Batman should be dark. But it doesn't need to be so sadistic to work you over so crudely from scene to scene. The Dark Knight has no wit, visual or otherwise. It doesn't achieve what Tim Burton's Batman, for all its screw-ups, did, creating a gothic urban landscape that was a breathtaking correlative for Batman's inner world. Nolan sets it in the real world, and while it's shocking and effective to see the Joker's opening heist pitched like Michael Mann, the novelty of the realism wears off. Even the most wondrous visions, Batman's plunges from skyscrapers, batwings snapping open, unbelievably cool in IMAX, can't keep the movie airborne. Bale is entertaining. His Batman rasps his lines in a voice that's deeper and hammier than ever, and the others are fine, but never mind them. Everyone wants to know about Heath Ledger. His Joker is a psychopath, a clown demon with smudged grease paint who bugs his eyes and licks at the gashes extending his mouth. First he sounds like Cagney in White Heat, then throws in Brando flourishes. He's scary, fast with sharp objects, but apart from a gruesome bit with a pencil, not terribly prankish. This is rave and rage and purge acting. Ledger works so very hard to fill the screen that he's both riveting and exhausting to watch. He's the first Joker who doesn't look like he's having fun. And it's contagious.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.